You're listening to the Pulse of the Eastern Townships on CGMQ 88.9 FM. I'm William Crooks, and today's show is produced with support from the Local Journalism Initiative. We have two important conversations lined up. First, we look at the spread of raccoon rabies in our region. Wildlife officials have expanded restrictions on transporting certain animals, and another round of vaccination operations is being prepared for 2026. I spoke with Marianne Gagné, Quebec's Provincial Coordinator for Rabies Management, about what's happening around Stanstead and what residents should keep in mind heading into the winter season. Then we shift to a very different topic, the lesser-known risks associated with extreme forms of meditation. Unlike everyday mindfulness, these practices can involve long silent retreats, total darkness, and sensory deprivation. Bishop's University psychology professor Adriana Mendrek joins me to explain where the risks actually lie and why most people still benefit from meditation when it's approached thoughtfully. All that and more coming up on the Pulse of the Eastern Townships. You're listening to the Pulse of the Eastern Townships on CGMQ 88.9 FM. I'm William Crooks, and this segment is produced with the support from the Local Journalism Initiative. Today we're looking at the latest developments in the spread of raccoon rabies across our region. Quebec wildlife authorities have expanded a ban on transporting certain wild animals and are preparing another round of vaccination operations for 2026. I spoke with Marianne Gagné, the province's coordinator for rabies management, who explained the emerging outbreak around Stanstead and why public vigilance remains essential. She also outlined how many animals were vaccinated this year, the risks to pets and people, and what residents should do if they encounter wildlife acting strangely. Here's what she had to say.
We issued on the 3rd, we issued a press release, and it was about the ban on transporting animals in certain regions. And it's a ban that we're just extending. It's been in place since June. And this ban is to avoid transporting any kind of raccoons, skunks, foxes, or even coyotes that are alive and that could be incubating, infected with rabies. But sometimes they seem healthy, although they can be developing the disease weeks to months later. So there's a ban right now on transporting those animals. Even if they're nuisance, they just want to move them a few kilometers away. It's prohibited right now. What we've been doing in the last year is to combat raccoon rabies in the province. We have a main outbreak in I would say Saint-Armand, Frelinsburg area, which is more the western part of the Eastern Township region, right? And that area is the main outbreak there. And we just seen since August, there's a new outbreak on the rise in Stanstead East Ogden area, where cases have been found since August. We have 9 cases in that area. And this is closely related to an outbreak that is raging right now in the northeastern Vermont, in the area of Derby, Coventry, and all that, just south of the Memphremagog Lake. And there's many cases of raccoon rabies in wildlife, and raccoon mainly, that have been found since the spring. So we kind of see the tip of that outbreak kind of emerging in the south, along the border and in Stanstead area.
So is that why the ban was extended?
The ban, it's not only for that. It's just for all the municipalities with raccoon rabies or within a radius of 50 kilometers of those cases. It's really to prevent any movement, even if people they don't want to do anything bad, but they could be moving this infected animal without knowing. So the ban is not really necessarily for that new outbreak, that second outbreak in Stanstead. It's just in general, a general measure that is recommended, it's extended to make sure people are not moving animals.
Okay, so what do residents of these areas need to know?
Well, first of all, rabies is a deadly disease. As soon as the symptoms of the disease appear, if it's in an animal or even in a human, it's deadly at 100% rate. So there's no way to treat the disease. So that's why we deploy those operations to control the disease in wildlife population. That's what we've been doing since 2024 more actively, because there was cases just out of the border in Vermont. So that's really to protect, not so much to protect animal, but really to protect human health that we're doing those operations. And for, you know, the general public, what we tell people to do is avoid any contact with wildlife at any time, because they could be carrying the disease even if they look healthy or harmless or, you know, orphan or, you know, in a bad, yeah, you just let nature, you know, follow its course, and that's the best to do with wildlife. People, they just want to help, although it's better to stay away from wildlife because they're carrying, you know, rabies, but there's also other diseases and parasites that can be transmitted to humans. So, to do. And also, we're seeking for the collaboration of the population to report any strains acting safely and sensitive to Ogden, like even all the way to Mega, Coaticook, and all that, that kind of valley, all the way to Sherbrooke. We're looking for the collaboration of the population to report any strains acting or like abnormally aggressive or paralyzed, or, you know, they look a bit dumb, they look a bit like, you know, that's like weird, like if it's raccoons, skunks, or foxes. Or even if someone finds like a carcass of one of those species dead on its property, it's to report those animals. There's a form online that people can fill out at any time. We also have a phone number. It's that, so 1-877-346-6763. So that's from Monday to Friday, though, from 8:30 to 4:30 on opening hours. But the form online is really easy to fill out, and it's, you know, 24/7. And we're going to, if the animal is of interest for surveillance, we're going to go get it. We will euthanize it if it's alive and sick. And we're going to test it for rabies. So that way, the coverage of the population, when they report injecting or found dead animals that are of interest for our surveillance, we can find out where rabies is on the territory, on the landscape, and at which, like, level of intensity. You know, there's a lot of cases, and where is it? So to adjust our operation of control operation, vaccination accordingly, and also it helps it inform public health to adjust also their measure on human vaccination when it's needed as well.
Tell me a bit more about your vaccination measures.
That's right, that's right. Oh, something I forgot about the public, what they should do is also if you have, like, if people, they have a pet, you know, that goes outside, especially cats or dogs or even, like, stray cats or even, you know, animals that are, sorry, like, livestock and stuff. Well, especially dogs and cats, they should have them vaccinated against rabies right now. And if they have livestock or other animals that they're wondering if they should vaccinate them, they should ask their veterinarian to make sure, you know, what's recommended in this situation. But that's something really important, because vaccinated your pet is going to protect human against rabies as well, because a dog that is infected by a raccoon could transmit it to the family, right? That's an important thing as well. Yeah. So sorry, and there's something else. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure I don't forget anything about human health. Sure. You know, if someone gets bitten or has a contact with the saliva, with like a wound or like a membrane or something, it's the way the rabies is transmitted. It doesn't transmit through the air or anything, so there's no risk that way. The risk is really when you have a direct contact with a wild animal or unknown animal, let's say a feral cat or something like that. If you get bitten or scratched, you should wash the wound, like even if it's minor, for 10 to 15 minutes with water and soap, and then phone Info Santé at 811 to, they're going to do an evaluation, and if needed, they're going to recommend the vaccination. That's something quite important. Anyway, so I think it's all you got all the recommendations in there.
Sometimes vaccination packets are dropped from helicopters, right?
Yeah, we did it like in that Eastern Township. We did it by plane at the beginning of August. So we covered like about 20 kilometers along the border in August with planes. And then we also in August we did some trapped fast vaccinate and release operation. It was really in Stansted area before we found the first cases in the province. It would prevent any entry or the spreading of the disease like further towards like Sherbrooke. And we did about 100 kilometers square along the border in Stansted area. We did a month of steps. No trapping, vaccinate and release lice, raccoon and skunks. And we caught that with a bit over 650 different raccoons that we were able to vaccinate by an injection that way. So it was kind of a measure that we added to the vaccine bait drop that we did by plane. It was done in August, and still it was about a month, beginning of August to beginning of September. And after that, we did like this fall, at the end of October, we went again for like a fall baiting, so we fall vaccination. So we did that manual. We went on the ground with, and like we used even fat bikes this year to try it out, and then we did like vaccination by distributing those vaccine baits manually on the ground in like the open day barns along the water course near houses and stuff like that where raccoons or even like where people are baiting some deer, you know, like a raccoon can be really attracted in during the hunting season to the pile of apples and carrots in the woods. So the vaccine be distribution to try to boost the immunity, you know, the number of raccoon that are immunized against rabies in the area to prevent the spreading towards Sherbrooke and Magog and all that.
Are you doing anything different now, or will you do anything different in the future?
Well, we'll do some kind of vaccination operation in 2026, that's for sure. I mean, we'll have probably to do this for a few years to make sure that, you know, we try to control and then we are able to eliminate raccoon rabies from the province, you know, for the Saint-Armand-Farnham outbreak, but also for the Stansted area as well. But the exact plan will be like shared more in the spring. Right now, we're kind of the planning process. You know, we're looking at what we've done. We're looking at the cases in the province, also in Vermont. So we're looking at different strategies, and it should be again some vaccine-based distribution, but we might add some other measures according to the situation at the time. But in the winter for us is really the time to do the planning of next year's operation to control raccoon rabies.
You've been listening to the Pulse of the Eastern Townships on CGMQ 88.9 FM. My thanks to Marianne Gagne from the Ministry of the Environment, the Fight Against Climate Change, Wildlife and Parks for taking the time to explain Quebec's efforts to contain raccoon rabies. As she stressed, avoiding contact with wildlife, reporting unusual behavior, and keeping pets vaccinated are key steps everyone can take. The province will release its 2026 vaccination strategy in the spring and will keep following these developments closely, especially as the outbreak near the border continues to shift. For more local reporting, visit cgmqnews.com, and as always, keep your finger on the pulse. You're listening to the Pulse of the Eastern Townships on CJMQ 88.9 FM. I'm William Crooks. Today's segment looks at a side of meditation that doesn't often make the headlines. While mindfulness is widely promoted for stress relief, focus, and emotional well-being, there's also emerging research on how extreme forms of contemplative practice, long silent retreats, dark retreats, and sensory reduction environments can sometimes lead to unexpected and even distressing experiences. To help us understand the difference between everyday mindfulness and the far more demanding practices taking place at the edges of the contemplative world, I spoke with Bishop's University psychology professor Adriana Mendrek. She's a longtime practitioner herself, and she explains why most people benefit from meditation, why a small number may struggle, and how individual differences play a major role. Here's our conversation. Professor Mendrek, meditation and mindfulness are popular current practices, but do they have some dangers people need to know about?
Yeah,
sure they do, but I mean, you know, again, I wouldn't dismiss them for sure. I mean, I am a big proponent of mindfulness meditation or various contemplative approaches, and I'm a practitioner myself. But it's true that in some rare, on some rare occasions, you might see undesirable effects, you know, depending on who is doing it, how is doing it, what type of practices. So for example, any form of long-term retreats, right? Silent retreats or dark retreats, or, you know, where maybe you don't sleep well, maybe there is a limited amount of food, so there might be some sleep deprivation and other stuff. There are studies showing that a small percentage of people might start experiencing, you know, unusual, sometimes pleasant, but sometimes unpleasant, almost psychotic-like experiences. Right? But that's very, but that's, remember, that these are kind of extreme conditions, right? So it's not just meditation that's going on there, but there's a variety of other things. There is solitude, silence, maybe you don't look at other people, you don't talk to anybody, depending really what you do and how you arrive, right? And what place, maybe you already enter retreat with some problems, psychological problems.
I see. So there might be some kind of underlying condition that's triggered by these extreme practices.
Yeah, yeah. So there are different takes, right? Some people think, yes, you know, we see these adverse effects because there is already predisposition to, let's say, some psychotic symptoms or maybe anxiety or depression. Others say, maybe this is because the practice is too intense, maybe prolonged, maybe it's hours and hours in immobility or whatever it is. And then others say, well, maybe it's a teacher. You know, maybe teacher is not skillful and doesn't know how to follow up with students. So it's not clear, but for sure, you know, for me, one thing I always, when I talk to people about it, when I talk to students about those stuff, we're all different. There are individual differences. I always recommend to people to try things and see what works. And usually we know. I mean, we kind of feel, you know, it feels right or it doesn't. I mean, you know, it's difficult at first overall to meditate, to start, you know, to not be flooded by avalanche of different thoughts, but eventually you have some clarity and you can see, you know, is this working, it's not working, or am I maybe, for whatever reason, become more anxious? Maybe I should try a different form of meditation. Maybe instead of just sitting immobile in darkness or whatever it is, maybe I could try walking meditation, right? Which can be also really wonderful. Is it Tai Chi or Qigong or is it yoga or other stuff? So I think it's also up to us a little bit individually to explore what works. But overall, listen, there is overwhelming evidence showing all kinds of benefits of meditation. So I would not want to undermine that. Nevertheless, yes, there is a chunk of people that, you know, again, for whatever reason, is there some kind of traumatic experience in the past? And now, let's say, they are told to focus on their breath, and somehow, actually, the breath or focusing on bodily sensations brings back those traumatic experiences. So, you know, maybe first they need to deal with that. Or try some other form of meditation, a different way of focusing your attention. Maybe not breath, maybe not sensations, maybe, you know, some sort of open monitoring, open awareness, or maybe you know, looking at the flame, I don't know, or repeating mantras. I mean, there are so many different meditations, right?
Is there any kind of data where you can tell beforehand that you might be one of these people at risk?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. You know, it's one of those things, I would say overall, people who have tendency or some sort of predisposition to hearing voices, I would say that probably these people would benefit more from much more structured and guided meditations, right? Mind doesn't go to some woo esoteric stuff. Rather than sitting in complete silence or following, you know, more new age approaches where there is talk about some energy passing through, or I don't know, there's a variety. I'm more popularist in that approach. I mean, I really love meditative, contemplative practices, but not necessarily, you know, new agey stuff, let's just say.
So yeah, but can you tell, at the same time, you know, at the same time I'm saying that, but I give you one example. It's anecdotal evidence, of course, so you know, I wouldn't rely on it, but I used to teach yoga, and I was teaching a type of strange esoteric yoga, Kundalini yoga, which is considered esoteric. And there's a whole, you know, there's a whole background there that is pretty strange. For me, it just, you know, it worked. So it didn't matter that there were all kinds of, I don't know, how should I call it? All kinds of, you know, esoteric, unexplained theories about it. Personally, it worked, you know, whatever you consider it working. For me, it was wonderful. I was teaching that, a mild version. And that type of yoga, when it was associated, and Qigong had the same association, there are a few papers on that, with possibility of developing psychotic symptoms, right? I mean, very, super rare, and in people with predispositions. At the same time, I had in my classes, often there was a person who was coming, who told me that she was diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, and that this type of yoga was helping, you know, not other types, more mellow or, you know, restorative, but specifically this one. So you can never tell, I think, you know, 100%. Or this is it, if you have these sort of symptoms, maybe you shouldn't do this practice. I think it's really a question of just trying things out and seeing what happens. And so, and going gradually, especially if you, you know, if you experiencing some mental health issues, maybe you don't want to right away go for a silent retreat for 2 weeks, maybe you want to start with, you know, 15 minutes or 10 minutes even daily sessions and see how it goes and do little meditations and see what happens and see, you know, how you feel.
Some of these more extreme practices sound like sensory deprivation tanks. Are you familiar with those things?
Yes, I never tried. I would love to try one, but yeah, that would be cool. Yeah, I mean, not for everybody again. Yeah, so that's actually very accurate comparison to some of, like, you know, say more extreme or more prolonged practices. So I've done, you know, and I'm talking about that. I've done several silent retreats. I mean, you could say some of them kind of extreme, where you know, sit in practice, you meditate 10 hours a day, you immobile, you sort of, you know, you don't look at anybody, you're in silence, you don't read, you don't write, there's nothing else. There's just practice and eating, you know, mindful eating and not eating much. And you might, in my case, I wasn't sleeping much, so I was sleep deprived. So, and I thought exactly when I was
at my first retreat like that, I thought about sensory deprivation because I was deprived of, you know, a lot of sensations. But you see, in my case, that resulted in an amazingly augmented sensitivity, and it was actually very pleasant. So, for example, taking a shower was just the sensual extravaganza, you know, incredible. Hearing birds singing in the forest, symphony, like an orchestra playing, incredible. And when I left the retreat, very, very sensitive. But I went to that retreat feeling great. I was in a good place and also experienced some strange stuff, except that I could explain it. Okay, I understand. I'm sitting. I'm immobile. Yeah, obviously, I have some strange sensations or hearing things because there is the sensory deprivation. But I was thinking about people who maybe don't have the same explanations. Where do they go with that? You know, and you can go into, oh, I'm having an awakening, or you can go, wow, what's happening with me? This is wrong, right? There's something really wrong with me or with what's being done here, and you can really spiral down. But yes, I thought about that, and I think the sensory deprivation, I think I would enjoy it. I would love to try it, but again, not something that I would recommend to everybody. You know, so again, maybe something to try for a few minutes if you have access and see what happens. You know, like dark retreats. I've never done that. I'd like to try. I don't think I would want to do more than a couple of days, but I'm curious. But I'm just curious a person. So, but I imagine, and I've met many people on retreat who did report, you know, hearing voices, seeing lights, and other things. And it's a perfectly natural response of the nervous system that is deprived of stimulation. It starts creating things. It's a very natural response. And so when we know that, I think, then, oh, it's okay. You know, when you ingest LSD or magic mushrooms or whatever, as long as you know you are on shrooms or on LSD, well, you can, even if you're having a bad trip, you're like, okay, it's gonna pass, right? It's just a few more hours. I have to survive. But the moment you lose that knowledge, you forget, you completely lost, it can be terrifying. And so I think it's the same thing in these circumstances. You know, is it sensory deprivation or is it some extreme form of meditative retreat? And actually, traditionally, you sort of after dissolution of your ego, right? Dissolution of self. And it can be incredible experience. But it can be also very frightening. I mean, you stop existing. You could say you are practicing death and non-existing as this you, you know, with your name, et cetera, and all the stories. It's interesting. So it's interesting how we, you know, there's a lot to be gained from different forms of meditation, especially those that give you some insight into the nature of yourself and of the universe, and especially those that are sort of rooted in ethics. We often forget about that in the way we translated some meditation in the West, you know, from the East and taken these approaches. But it's just something, you know, to try. Maybe it works for you, or maybe you prefer just a nice walk in the forest. That could be, you know, form of meditation, and that's fine. Yeah.
You've been listening to my conversation with Bishop's University psychology professor Adriana Mendrick on CGMQ 88.9 FM. As she explained, the risks associated with meditation are real but rare, and they're tied to practices far more intense than what most people encounter in everyday mindfulness classes. Her message was clear. Meditation remains overwhelmingly beneficial, but people exploring more extreme forms should proceed gradually, understand the sensory effects that can arise, and choose practices that match their personal needs and mental state. For more news and interviews, check out cgmqnews.com. And as always, keep your finger on the pulse. That brings us to the end of today's program on CGMQ 88.9 FM. My thanks to Marianne Gagné for outlining Quebec's outgoing efforts to contain raccoon rabies, and to Professor Adriana Mendrek for helping us understand the fine line between everyday mindfulness and the more demanding, sometimes risky, forms of extreme contemplative practice. For more stories and interviews, check out cgmqnews.com. We'll continue following the rabies situation closely as the province prepares its 2026 vaccination strategy, and we'll keep exploring the research behind mental health practices that shape our lives here in the townships. Thanks for listening to the Pulse of the Eastern Townships, and as always, keep your finger on the pulse.